we've entered the realm of economic nationalism and also food nationalism. And really, you could say economic isolationism as well. And this is all really critical stuff to understand because this is not World War II. So in World War II, when the United States ran a naval embargo against Japan to cut off Japan's oil supply and try to provoke Japan into attacking Pearl Harbor in order to have all the pictures of dead soldiers that would motivate the American people to join the Pacific War theater. By the way, that's what that was all about. That's why Pearl Harbor was allowed to happen under Roosevelt. But that system of economic isolationism, the only reason it worked then was because America had major manufacturing. You know, America made cars and made tanks and made airplanes and steel and clothing and everything you can imagine. America was a major manufacturing hub. And in fact, throughout World War II, the United States was the primary manufacturer and supplier of all these physical goods that were shipped across even the Atlantic Ocean. They were shipped to the theater of war in Europe by the boatload, literally. And that's why the Germans ran their U-2 boats, the submarines, trying to torpedo the supply ships that were coming out of America. And it was ammunition, and it was radios, and it was boots, and it was, you know, clothing and food and everything and tanks and whatever. And America, it was America's economic output that essentially made the victory in World War II possible, because so many of the cities in Europe were bombed out, including cities in France, for example. And so the economies of the UK and France were very suppressed by Germany. And it really took America's economic might to defeat the Germans by just having more bullets, more tanks, you know, more airplanes, more everything. Well, think about how different the world is today compared to then. Today, the United States manufactures very little compared to what we did, 70 plus years ago. Very little. The manufacturing is now in Japan and in Korea and China, and the minerals and the fertilizer comes from, of course, Belarus and Ukraine and Russia and, in many cases, South America as well. But we now have this global supply chain system that when you resort to economic isolationism or protectionism, the whole world suffers because the world is built on the efficiencies of international trade that require what you could call the liquidity of goods and services crossing borders, where one country is good at growing wheat, another country is good at mining aluminum, another country is good at making electronics parts, and so on and so forth. And then these countries trade with each other, and the whole world benefits as a result. The whole world has affordable food. The whole world has affordable automobiles, let's say. Or the whole world has affordable fertilizer. So all of that now has been just severed. The Western nations declared economic warfare against Russia, but in doing so, by cutting off the SWIFT system, they've actually declared economic warfare against all the people of the planet, including people living in the US and Canada and the UK and so on. And then what immediately happened, or around the same time, you had food nationalism or food protectionism from countries like Hungary and Ukraine and Russia, all announcing a ban on the exports of food supplies. So now we're facing a situation that we have not faced ever in the history of known civilization. We're facing a situation where you have these very complex and delicate interrelationships with international trade, a system that is so complex that no one can even mentally grasp the interconnections and the prerequisites and requirements and so on throughout the supply chain. That system now suddenly meeting economic protectionism and nationalism and the severing of all these ties, the debanking of Russia. This is an engineered economic apocalypse. And as I've said before, even the people who made these decisions thinking that they were going to punish Russia, even those people who run the Western nations and who run the central banks, even those people had no idea what they have unleashed because they don't understand the implications. So you see, complex societies are very vulnerable to collapse. Complex societies are, by definition, very fragile. Whereas simple societies, or what we might call flat economies, typically agrarian economies, they have very high levels of redundancy and resiliency, and they live closer to collapse. I've told the story many times of visiting the Indians in Peru, high-altitude farmers who would grow in the Andes Mountains. They would grow papas, which is potatoes, and they would have oxen, beasts of burden, pulling wooden plows, and they would grow quinoa, and they had llamas, and they would do rainwater collection. They had no electricity, no technology, and so on. If the internet goes down and the power grid goes down and fossil fuels go down, they don't even notice it in places like that because they live close to what we would consider to be a collapse scenario anyway. And there are people who live that way all over the world, in the Andes Mountains, in Central and South America, in Africa, in Papua New Guinea, in Southeast Asia, and many other places around the world. Those people are going to be fine because they've already learned how to live in that system. It is the multiple billions of people who are used to living in complex, modern, first world economies that are going to be the ones who die because they don't know how to live without the advantages and the cost efficiencies of a highly complex global society that's based on logistics and transportation and just-in-time delivery. And, you know, having hundreds of vendors providing products that go into making one Toyota car, for example. These people living in the first world countries, they have no idea what it takes to bring them a loaf of bread at the store or to deliver a car to them at a Toyota dealership or to manufacture, well, just about anything like a flat screen TV. So they're going to suffer a very long fall from their high altitude loftiness of having everything is convenient. It's delivered by Uber Eats and everything's just in time and it's Amazon Prime and all of that. When you lose that among a population of people who don't know where their food comes from and who don't know how to survive without electricity, then you get a mass die-off. You get panic, you get riots, you get violence, you get desperation and then destitution and then starvation, famine. It gets ugly. Whereas, again, the people living in the Andes Mountains are like, that's pretty much the same. We've been living this way for, you know, centuries, and we're still here. Meanwhile, the people in Democrat cities and so on are living through a war zone. It's like Chaz, but everywhere, with, you know, human traffickers and gangs. And they're trying to dodge bullets and get out on foot, but they don't know how to get out of their cities without using a car, but the cars aren't working because there's no fossil fuels. And besides, there's armed road checkpoints that are kidnapping women and children and so on. And, you know, it's a bad scene. This is why it's good to learn how to live in a low-tech environment or a no-tech environment. And I guess I'll plug my new upcoming free book. It's not really a plug if it's free, I guess, but it's free. It's called Resilient Prepping. It's coming out soon. And it talks about how to survive the total collapse of civilization in a no-tech world. It gives you scenarios for survival without any fossil fuels, without any electricity, no power grid, nothing. And you can register to be alerted via email. Just go to resilientprepping.com, enter your email address. We'll send you an email when the download is available. It's completely free. Audio files, MP3, and a PDF transcript. And that's coming out within a couple weeks here. So that's definitely worth your attention to get that book and learn from it. But what you can do in the meantime is think about your own preparedness plans and think about, hey, what do you have that can function without fossil fuels, without combustion engines, without a power grid? And for most people, when they look at their survival supplies, they're not really that deep in terms of being able to survive in a no-tech scenario. So a lot of what we will do, and by the way, I have some high-tech survival things like, you know, night vision goggles, which is great, but they run on batteries. So where do you get batteries? Well, in a collapsed society, you don't get them. So you start to look for strategies of things like, oh, can you recharge certain types of batteries using a a solar panel and a solar generator based on a lithium battery that might actually last a few years. And then you realize, well, there's only one type of battery that actually works to power a lot of gear, and that's called the 18650 battery. And it's named that because it's 18 millimeters in diameter and it's 650 millimeters in length, by the way, 18650. And you realize that's the only reliable battery for recharging. And then you start to think about, well, gosh, do we have gear that runs on 18650 batteries? You know, you start to rethink all your gear, all your supplies. And you also realize at some point that this stuff's not going to last forever no matter what. At some point, the night vision goggles break down. At some point, the solar generator stops working. At some point, every engine you have in every vehicle stops functioning and you need an oil filter or an air filter or something. You need a belt to drive the alternator and the fan on your tractor, right? And eventually, if society collapses, eventually all technology collapses with it, although it might take time. Eventually, you don't even have Mad Max because you don't even have vehicles. Eventually, you don't have firearms with bullets because the bullets run out, although that might take a long time. But eventually you end up needing edged weapons, things that don't require ammo. And you need low-tech or no-tech communication systems and repair systems and so on. And you have to return to an old-style world, kind of like an 18th century or 19th century existence, where you have blacksmiths and you have simple systems like hand-powered sewing machines to repair the holes in your clothes. And you need to be able to repair a garden hoe or a rake or a shovel or things like that. And you also realize, once you really examine that kind of system, you realize that planet Earth, without the use of the power grid and without the use of combustion engines, can only support somewhere between 1 and 2 billion people, and that's it. You just don't have these efficiencies. So you realize that if that kind of collapse happens, you're going to lose between 6 and 7 billion people who are living today, which is getting close to, you know, like in what, 87% die off or something close to that. Yeah, these are some sobering thoughts. And then you realize that the survivors will be those who learn how to live without modern technology. And that's what I'm really working on teaching and learning and demonstrating in videos and things like that. How to grow food, medicine, how to solve your own problems at the community level, locally. So we've got a lot more to come on these topics and many others. So just, you know, stay informed. You can follow me on naturalnews.com and also brighttown.com. I'm Mike Adams. I've got a daily situation update podcast that you've probably heard, and I'm putting that out every day. So thank you for listening. I really appreciate you. God bless you. Get prepared. Take care.